God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Ready for argument on our first case, United States versus Lawing. Mr. Coulter, I'd be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. On May 3rd, 2010, Deputy Navas of the Rowan County Sheriff's Department conducted a warrantless stop of a gray Lexus driven by the defendant, Talvin Lawing. It was passenger Monica Lowe in the front passenger seat of the vehicle. The stop and subsequent search was predicated on information provided by a confidential informant to Detectives Alderman and Meyer a short time before, that the gray Lexus driven by a person known only as Drew at that time would be transporting between a quarter and a half ounce of cocaine. This information about the cocaine turned out to be incorrect in that no narcotics were found in the vehicle. However, during a course of the search for narcotics, a sawed-off shotgun was found in the trunk of the vehicle under a carpet in a tire well. There was also two shotgun shells found in the glove box of the car. In denying the defendant's motion to suppress, the trial court found that the information provided by the confidential informant was sufficiently reliable to justify both the stop and the search. Specifically, the court noted that the officers had the opportunity to judge the informant face-to-face. However, neither the Supreme Court of the Fourth Circuit has ever created a rule that an informant is per se reliable because he was met by law enforcement face-to-face. The officers knew little about the confidential informant. The only contact they'd had with him was a phone call to Detective Alderman about a week earlier leaving a message. The meeting was set up, and Detective Alderman met with the informant about a half hour before the stop of the defendant's vehicle. Detective Alderman, based on his testimony, made little, if any, inquiry about the confidential informant's background. The informant had never provided any previous information or made any control buys for law enforcement or just demonstrated his reliability in any way. And unlike United States versus White, the confidential informant never testified at the suppression hearing. And the trial court was therefore in a...
Is there any requirement that happen?
No, Your Honor, but since the keystone of the ruling here is the informant's reliability, it puts the court in a much better position to determine whether the officers had reason to believe that the informant was reliable. In White...
They knew what he looked like, they knew his name, they knew where to find him, and he made an admission against his penal interest. So those are all indicators the court can take into account to weigh on whether or not that's sufficient.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the statement of penal interest, there was no indication whether the informant realized that could be used against him, and under the corpus delicti rule, it's very unlikely he would ever have been prosecuted. And moreover, the informant's admission that he was a cocaine user, I would contend, doesn't really enhance his credibility a great deal. As far as being held accountable for false allegations, no cocaine was found in the vehicle, yet no punitive action was taken against the informant.
At the suppression hearing, where you say the confidential informant was not present, does the procedure permit the defendant to seek to have him brought to the hearing?
Your Honor, while it was one of the detectives admitted the name of the informant during the course of the hearing, counsel was unaware of, until that point, of exactly who he was. Moreover, since this was a warrantless stop and search, it's the government's burden of proof to show some exception to the warrant requirement. So we would...
If there was no... I mean, to answer Judge Wynn's question, there's no prohibition on the defense counsel seeking that witness.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Whether or not you do, I mean, that's your judgment to make, but there's nothing that stops you from doing that.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
And my point being is that, on the one hand, the government does have the burden at the hearing, but if you know that the law is such that his presence is not required, it seems as though what you're really now making is more of a confrontational type determination, and my question was going to, did you request him there?
I did not, Your Honor. While I was generally aware of who we thought the informant was, I did not ask to have him subpoenaed, Your Honor.
Did they, and here it seemed, didn't the fact show that the police officers actually met with the confidential informant?
That is correct.
In a face-to-face, doesn't that make a difference where they actually meet a confidential informant?
Your Honor, as the cases indicate, the courts have given more credence where the officers do meet face-to-face with the informant. But in this case, they knew very little about the informant.
But he, the fact, and I think, you know, these facts are really close, but for one thing I think happened here, and that is, wasn't there some conversation between the confidential informant and this person so-called Drew to speak?
Yes, it was a recorded conversation.
And the officers were present?
That was correct, Your Honor.
And heard him make to this so-called person named Drew on this cell phone this offer to buy or cocaine, and it was made in their presence?
They heard one side of a conversation that was, in fact, recorded, Your Honor. However,
when you say one side, you only heard just what side?
They only heard the informant's side. That was, let me be more clear, Your Honor. Detective Myers testified he heard one side of the conversation. The conversation was, in fact, recorded, and both parties were heard on that recording.
So they had both parties on the recording, and then link up that with the phone call that's made to the cell phones in the car, go off twice, and it rings twice. It's not enough for a reasonable doubt, but you don't need that, do you?
No, only a probable cause to search the vehicle. As to the recording, Your Honor, Detective Myers testified that he only heard one side of the conversation and did not review the recording. Detective Alderman was not specific in his testimony, but it seemed that he only heard one side of the conversation as well.
But he did predict the path, knew the route he was going to take, and that's how they identified the vehicle.
He did, but as the Justice Ginsburg indicated in Florida versus J.L., the knowledge of a person's future movement indicates some familiarity with a person's affairs, but having such knowledge does not necessarily imply the informant knows in particular whether the person is carrying hidden contraband.
Well, J.L. was a completely anonymous confidential.
It was, but the passage I've just quoted, the court does not make any distinction between anonymous tips and face-to-face meeting. They point out that there's a difference between being able to show familiarity with the subject and showing knowledge of criminal activity. And back to the recording, the recording was never played at the suppression hearing. When questioned on cross-examination, Detective Alderman and Detective Myers both indicated they couldn't remember what was said, even in the most general way. They only knew that they formed a belief based on that conversation that Drew would be delivering cocaine. And this is different than some of the other cases where the recording were played. Again, it's the government's burden of proof to show that probable cause existed. The description of Drew as well, Going back to Florida versus JL, it indicates an accurate description of the subject's readily observable location and appearance is reliable in a limited sense. It will help the police correctly identify the person the tipster means to accuse. Such a tip does not show the tipster has knowledge of concealed criminal activity. But again, there's a difference between showing the informant showing he knows somebody and the informant providing reliable information that the subject was involved in criminal activity. As to the phone issue, you mentioned Judge Wynn. Essentially, what happened was when Deputy Navas stopped the vehicle, there's some dispute as to how he got the phones, whether Detective Bacot ordered him to receive the phones or whether Detective Bacot got the phones directly. But basically, the defendant was ordered to give over his cell phone, which he did. At some point thereafter, Detective Myers indicated he would be calling the number provided by Drew. Sometime thereafter, the cell phone belonging to the defendant rang. There was no indication that any law enforcement officer ever determined that that call came from Detective Myers. That is, they didn't answer the phone. They didn't look to see the number it came from. The only evidence was that the phone rang. As soon as that happened, the government proceeded to search the vehicle without more.
Would the court be entitled to draw the inference that if the officer testified he called that number twice, and twice when he called it, it rang, that there was a high probability that that was the number that he called?
That would be a reasonable inference, and that's the inference that the court drew. I just point out that this is not a case where it was determined specifically who the phone call came from. Again, it is circumstantial evidence, but there was no specific determination of who exactly the call came from. Probable cause required for the search of the vehicle is treated significantly different in the case law than reasonable suspicion for a stop in informant cases. Most of the cases cited by the government their brief rely on cases regarding the stop of a vehicle. U.S. versus Singh involved the stop of a truck that had marijuana in it. In that case, the initial stop was based on the tow truck speeding. The case revolved around the duration of the stop and how much weight the trial court should have given the informant's tip during that. But it ultimately ended up being based on a consent search and a canine sniff before the search. Alabama versus White, which was also a reasonable suspicion case based on a stop. It was also a consent search.
Well, I think you could probably characterize this as a reasonable suspicion case, at least for the initial stop.
That's correct.
So you get that stop, but here where it changes is there's some additional information that's gathered to support the determination of probable cause. Probably the ringing of the phone is the strongest thing that government's relying upon here to convey that, well, there's probable cause to believe that there may be drugs on this vehicle, which then authorize a search, limited to some extent, which is simply the trunk and the glove compartment.
The only additional information after the stop that the police got was the ringing of the phone, and all that does is goes to the identity of the person stopped. There was no additional information such as nervousness, inconsistent statements between the parties.
But you can't ignore that the reason that they know this phone, that they have this number, is because of this buy that was made in this recorded conversation.
Well, I would argue that the The recorded conversation was not put into evidence. The detectives did not relate what was in it. All they said was their belief was that this was going to be a buy for cocaine. I would argue that is akin to a hunch that's prohibited under Terry. All the basically phone call did was confirm that Drew was the defendant, Talvin Long, which just basically indicates that the informant knew the person, not the criminal activity. It appears I've run out of time.
Thank you. You have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Joseph?
Thank you, members of the court, and thank you for allowing me the privilege of being here today. I would like to point out at the beginning that the defense knew the identity of the informant. At JA 70, lines 21, 20.
I missed that. The defense knew what?
The identity of the informant, mm-hmm. Your Honor, Judge Wynn. Mm-hmm. At JA 70, line 21, 22, on cross-examination, the defense was asking one of the witnesses the identity of the informant, and the witness said something, and the lawyer said, would that informant have been a William, and then states his name. I don't know that I should say it on the record here, but stated his name. Your Honor, I would submit that the record here does support Judge Schroeder's findings.
And what difference does it make that the defense knows the identity of the informant? Does that mean that then opens up to that if they want to know certain things, they can question this person or get information? Or
I don't know if it made a lot of difference at all, Judge Wynn, but it was pointed out that there was already some statement made they weren't sure who the informant was, and I just wanted to say that they did know. I don't know what difference it would have made. They could have subpoenaed him if they wanted to. They could have located him. They knew his name.
But what seems to flow when you have a confidential informant is that it's almost like you're being attacked in the dark. You don't know who it is, but these things are being said. But at least from what you are representing here, that once the defendant knows who it is, if you want to go and check this person out, you then can begin the process, unless the court has put a protective order or some kind of order, to say that you cannot reveal this person in the proceeding or you cannot bring these things out. And I guess none of that was done.
Well, I don't think there was any real contest about what happened. There was some, it could have been done. Yes, it could have been done. But I would submit that along with that, there's been some argument made here today that Myers and Alderman were uncertain about what the nature of the call was. And the record shows, especially on cross-examination, that Detective Myers said, yes, I heard the CI's at JA 91. He heard the CI's side of the conversation, and it was something to the effect he ordered up. I think it was $150 or $300 worth of crack. And Alderman also testified about the CI and said that at JA 7172, the CI said he'd purchased cocaine from Drew on several occasions. He was very familiar with him, knew how he operated. The CI normally purchased between $300 and $400 of cocaine at a time. Their testimony was they described the route. Myers testified about the CI describing the route where the Drew was going to drive at JA 76. Told him exactly how he was going to come.
Why was the recording not introduced at the suppression hearing?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that.
It seems fairly significant. I mean, everything you have here is you've got a confidential informant who gives information that ultimately turns out to be incorrect, at least in terms of the narcotics, but that's neither here nor there. Therefore, well, the reasonable suspicion stop. You've got to stop. Now you want probable cause, and you really just don't have anything, but you get the phone to ring.
Yes.
And as the defendant's attorney said, that may identify that this is the phone, but it doesn't connect with anything other than this is a person that this phone he may have called. And you don't have the evidence of what was said in that recording, which seems to me to be very significant.
Your Honor, I understand what...
say that recording is a buy. And this phone is ringing from where that buy has happened or an offer. It seems to be powerful to say probable cause probably exists. But without that, Was there testimony by the officers as to the substance of that recording?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, Judge Wynn.
They testified.
At JA 72, Judge Wynn, Your Honor, Alderman testified that on May 10th, the CI ordered $300 worth of cocaine, and he said about how much that it was between a quarter of an ounce and a half an ounce. They testified, Alderman and Myers testified about this call. And there's no requirement.
What did they say about the call? I got what the CI said to them, but what did they say in terms of connecting this call?
That's what I'm representing to the court, Your Honor. That they said that that's what they testified to. They heard the call, and they gave the substance of that call in their testimony.
Which was?
Which was that the CI called and ordered between a quarter to a half ounce of cocaine, and it was going to be between $300 and $400 worth. That's what they testified to.
But
and that's what
they did they hear someone on the other end of the phone or testify to that?
No, sir, they did not. But I would submit that's not required, especially in this case where the man that ordered it, told him what he did. He dealt with him before, said, I dealt with him many times, described he was going to make a turn on Old Beatty Ford Road.
Did the officer dial the number, or did the CI dial the number?
The CI dialed the number, but the officers had the number. The officers had the phone number. And then within 20 minutes, the call was made at 2:21 in the afternoon, Your Honor, Judge Wynn. And then at 20 minutes later, they gave out the information that he was going to drive a gray Lexus. Myers was wrong. He said it was a Volvo. But the officers on surveillance were given the information that it was going to be a gray or silver Lexus. One of the officers saw the Lexus arrive 20 minutes later, turn left at Old Beatty's Ford Road, just as predicted. And I would submit the only thing the officers did wrong here, Your Honor, I would submit there's a lot of things they could have done better, but one thing they did was they did this ordering up when the elementary school was letting out. And so when they decided to close in, they couldn't pull right up to the defendant's car. There were school buses. The officer that closed in was three car lengths back. He turned on his blue light, and by the time they got him stopped, there was no drugs. And the judge did ask at the suppression hearing if they ran a drug dog or something back, and they did. They couldn't locate anything. But I would submit that just because we don't know if there were drugs in that car or not, but it is true by the time they got him stopped, there were none.
Well,
there was a trace of cocaine found in the car.
It is true there's no quantity of drugs found, but I thought the record indicated in the glove compartment there were traces of cocaine.
There was Judge Floyd, there was a trace of cocaine powder found to the left side of the steering wheel. There was no cocaine found in the glove compartment. In the glove compartment, you had the shotgun shells and an ID that Officer Meyer said he looked at the ID, and it was the defendant's picture, and it was his name. But they didn't grab that ID.
Well, it just seems to me the most significant thing about this case, I mean, we could go on and on about the reasonable suspicion and what all happens. I think it seems to me the case is pretty much a lock, except for this business about this phone call because calling a phone and allowing it to ring, it doesn't give you probable cause. That alone doesn't do it. You've got to have something that connects that to say, okay, that's the phone he called to make this buy. So that's why I keep asking those questions about what was presented at the suppression hearing to connect that calling with that particular buy, because that's significant in my view. If you're sitting there with a confidential informant and you hear him talk to someone on this phone and make a buy and an agreement is all made, and you says, well, I just heard that, and then you rush out, stop this car, call that phone twice, and this guy's holding it, that's pretty strong stuff there. I mean, but if you don't have that, if all you have is he told me he was calling someone to buy a quarter ounce of cocaine, and he told me that he was talking to someone named Drew, who happens not to be the person that's in the car. At least I don't know who Drew is. Apparently, the record's not telling us anything about who Drew really was or why that difference was there. But aside from that, it's the connection of that particular buy with the ringing that seems to be the basis for the probable cause. I'm talking about the reasonable suspicion. I think it's there. But the probable cause is the problem.
All right, Your Honor. They listened to the phone call, and they were there when the phone call was made. They were at the informant's house. They knew where he lived. He lived right behind the elementary school.
And they recorded it.
They recorded it, and they had the
phone. They listened to the recording.
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know that. It's just something.
It
may have been, but I would submit, Your Honor, however prudent, it was not required. They had the phone number at JA 67. Officer Alderman testified he had the number, 704-431.
It was not required to do what?
They're not required to play the recording.
No,
They're not required to listen to it.
No, they're not. But they are required to have enough evidence to have probable cause.
Well, at this stage, they were. I would submit that when you look at everything in this totality, respectfully, Your Honor, that when they met with this person that said they knew who this Drew guy was that sold cocaine, he knew him very well. He bought from him in the past. It's a statement against his penal interest. That they were at his house. They knew who the informant was. They had his identity. That the informant called up. They listened to the call. Both officers testified. The call was made ordering cocaine and described how much and how much it was going to be. They had the phone number of the informant, of the person that was going to deliver it.
Gives them some reasonable suspicion.
They had officers out there.
That gives you the probable cause.
The probable cause is the totality of the circumstances. Is that when they had all of that, what happened before, as you've already talked about very well, that when they called that number and identified that number was the same number that the phone call was made from used to make the phone call for the ordering of the dope, then that sealed the deal. That at that point, they had it. And that's my argument.
Okay, I'm clear on your point. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's nothing further, thank you for allowing me to appear.
Mr. Coulter, you have some time in rebuttal.
May it please the court, there was in the government's argument there was some mention of what Detective Aldermans and Meyer did and didn't say about the recording. On JA 72, on cross-examination, Detective Alderman was asked, how many phone calls did Mr. Whitley make to Drew that you heard while I was there, one that was recorded? Now, were you able to listen to that recording? Yes, sir. Do you recall exactly what was said? Not exactly. Did Mr. Whitley ever mention cocaine specifically? I don't recall. Didn't Mr. Whitley say, I got that for you. Did you ever do anything? All right. Well, I need them three. Is that the extent of the conversation? I can't recall the specifics of it. Based on what was said, you know, he said he would be there in about 20 minutes. That's what I recall.
Who is Whitney?
He is the informant, apparently. And I need to go to Detective Myers, but going back to that, I was underlying counsel at the trial. I had some information from the defendant as to who the confidential informant might be. It was not confirmed by anyone until the cross-examination. It may have been better in hindsight, to have subpoenaed him. I'm wishing I had at this point. But that's...
You probably had good reason not to subpoena him.
That was a consideration as well, Your Honor. But that's... I believed who it was, but did not know specifically. If I spoke otherwise, I apologize. With Detective Meyer on J891, now, you mentioned you heard the CI side of the conversation on the phone call to Drew, correct? Yes, that's what I listened to. What specifically did you hear? I don't recall verbatim what was said, but it was something to the effect that he ordered up, I think, $150 or $300 worth of crack. Isn't it true that the CI never mentioned drugs specifically? Again, I don't recall specifically what he said. Then he gave a description of... Drew, that's what the detectives testified to at the suppression hearing. As to Your Honor's, Judge Lloyd's question about the any cocaine in the vehicle, there was some, both Detective Alderman and Detective Myers testified that no cocaine was in the vehicle, and Judge Schroeder found as finding that no cocaine was in the vehicle. However, Detective Navas testified that on his second or third search, he found a speck in a compartment to the left of the steering wheel that he field tested using the color test, and the sample was destroyed. It did turn blue, he indicated. That was the only other evidence. If Your Honors have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coulter. We do note that you are court-appointed, and the court expresses its appreciation for your willingness to undertake court-appointed activity. It's a great benefit to the work of the court.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for coming.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then move on to our next.